Donald Trump, he's a big fan of fossil fuels. Renewables? Not so much.
I don't want to just hope the wind blows to light up your homes and your factory.
What is the future of renewable energy under Donald Trump?
As the birds fall to the ground.
My name's Reed Frazier, and this is the Trump on Earth podcast.
And I know a lot about solar. The problem with solar, it's very expensive. It doesn't really, you know, when you have a 30-year payback, that's not exactly the greatest thing in the world.
Anybody that thinks that solar is expensive at the utility scale right now hasn't seen the latest.
Are recent gains made by solar and wind in jeopardy? Or is the momentum these industries have gained over the past 8 years made them borderline unstoppable? We'll talk this week with a man who's literally writing the book on the topic.
The book's about the future of solar energy, and tomorrow I have to make a choice between two titles, so you tell me which one you like. Taming the Sun?
I like that.
Or Saving Solar?
Kind of like the first one first. It's a little more, what's the word, literary or poetic or something?
I liked it too. Thanks for the feedback.
That's when Trump on Earth continues. Stay with us. Hello, Trump on Earth podcast listeners. Trump on Earth now has a page on Patreon. This is a way for people who listen to the podcast, like you're doing right now, to support our work and help defray the costs of studio rental and production of the podcast. It really would mean a lot to us to get that help. So just go to patreon.com/Trump on Earth to find out more. Thanks again, and back to Trump on Earth.
Every 2 years we hear, hey, you know, we got to get alternative energy. It never happens. Never. But you want more and more money on a phantom. It's a phantom.
I bet about 20 years ago we had a young Bill O'Reilly saying, I want to be a superstar. And people told you, it's a phantom. You'll never amount to
anything. But I did it on my own with no government subsidy. Okay?
What's the future of the renewables industry under President Donald Trump? Trump and many Republicans have said that renewables have gotten too sweet a deal under Democrats. And he's made clear his support for fossil fuels like coal and oil. Those traditional sources of energy still make the vast majority of our electricity in the U.S., but renewables have made big gains under the Obama administration. Here to talk about this is a man who's been following this topic with the Council on Foreign Relations. Varun Sivaram has been following energy policy as the Philip D. Reed Fellow for Science and Technology at the Council on Foreign Relations. Varun, welcome to Trump on Earth.
Thank you for having me.
Okay, so I wanted to start with an overview of where the renewable energy industry is. It seems like for years, I mean, since I was a kid, we've always been told that, you know, solar energy and windmills were kind of this, you know, utopian clean energy future, but it just hasn't seemed to happen until recently. Solar panels have been around since the 70s, windmills have been around forever, but it's only now they're really contributing serious portions to the electric grid. I looked some numbers up. In 2008, they contributed about 1%, wind and solar did, of the electricity in the U.S. This year, they've reached 10% or thereabouts. So renewables are kind of here. How would you characterize where this industry is right now?
I would say that both the wind and the solar industry have kind of come of age in the United States and around the world. Just to give some more specific numbers, in the United States, wind power generates a little less than 6% of the United States' electricity. Solar power is around 1%. But the progress made just in the last decade has been remarkable. Wind was kind of first out of the gate, but solar recently has been the one making the most gains. And just in 2016, in many parts of the world, solar became the cheapest form of electricity on the planet, even cheaper in many cases than coal power or natural gas power. I think that, just as you said, solar panels have been around for many decades. In fact, the first solar cell was invented in 1954. But they've only recently come of age as the cost of a solar panel has dropped 70% just since 2010.
Okay, so to the extent that they've taken off, what has happened that's made them more, you know, cost competitive with other types of energy? Is it because of government policies or interventions or subsidies?
In the case of solar, the initial push for solar happened because developed countries like Germany provided a lot of public incentives and subsidies to deploy solar power. Chinese manufacturers really took advantage of that. They ramped up production. And once Chinese manufacturers did that, they managed to drive the cost down considerably. So we can say that the initial boost towards solar came thanks to taxpayers in countries like Germany. Now that this ball is rolling down the hill and has gathered momentum, costs continue to plunge even though rich countries are pulling back their subsidies. Germany, for example, is slashing its subsidies for solar power. And so even though subsidies are falling, the scale of solar panel production is increasing and the scale of solar panel deployment in projects around the world is increasing. And that's driving down costs even further in a virtuous cycle.
So I want to go back to that cost question and China. There was a recent report from Reuters about the potential tariffs that the Trump administration could pose on Chinese solar panels. Can you explain this and what impact this could have on renewables in the United States?
Absolutely. So this has its roots back in the late 2000s when the Chinese government offered loans and loan guarantees to Chinese manufacturers of solar panels. These were, in fact, subsidies to their domestic producers, allowing them to produce solar panels well below the cost that it took to make them. And as a result, the United States and Europe in 2011 and 2012 and 2013 filed cases at the WTO alleging that China had dumped solar panels on the market. The effect of that dumping, by the way, was to put both German and American producers out of business. And many Silicon Valley firms with innovative new technologies also went out of business around that time. Now, the United States and Europe succeeded in winning their trade cases and then put countervailing tariffs, raising the price of Chinese imports into the European Union and the United States. But what China did, or what their companies did, was to shift production to other countries, for example, Malaysia, that wouldn't be hit with these tariffs. Now, most recently, a solar producer called Suniva has come and said that they're still not able to compete with solar panel imports from, for example, Malaysia, and therefore they're asking the Trump administration to impose a tariff on all solar panels that enter the United States that are made out of silicon, which is the dominant technology accounting for about 90% market share. And if this happens, it's really going to significantly raise the price of solar panels coming into the United States. I mean, already in the United States, the investment in the second quarter fell by a considerable amount, over $1 billion compared to the first quarter in solar projects, just because of the uncertainty or the fear that this trade action might be taken. So if the price of solar panels rises in the United States, that will really undercut the economics, especially of large-scale, or what we call utility-scale solar projects, big solar farms out in the desert. These solar farms, you know, have very low margins. They really need low cost if they're going to make back the upfront cost of building them by selling their power. And because they're selling their power quite cheaply, if the cost of the solar panel rises, they won't be able to make their money back. And as a result, investors are not going to want to invest in them. So long story short, if the trade case succeeds and the Trump administration does impose a tariff on all solar panels entering the United States, ostensibly in an effort to try and protect U.S. domestic manufacturers, what that would mean is that the deployment of solar power in the United States would fall sharply.
Do you think that's a realistic option? Do you think he would actually do that?
It's really hard to tell. It would be a terrible idea, in my opinion, and from the perspective of trying to increase the amount of solar power in the United States. But the Trump administration has been very clear that they intend to push a Buy America doctrine. And so if there's a way for them to make it easier for American manufacturers to produce panels by making foreign panels from every single country, not just China, more expensive, there is a possibility that they go ahead and do this. And the possibility is being recognized by markets and investors. And that's why there was a slowdown in investment. Now, I don't think this is a good idea for a few reasons. First, the United States has committed to reduce its emissions. President Trump has pledged to pull out of the Paris Agreement, but he hasn't yet. He's not allowed to until 2020. And right now, we are bound under an international commitment to reduce our emissions. And it's going to be a lot harder to do that if we can't deploy solar power at the rate we've already been doing. Second, In the effort to protect local manufacturing jobs by raising the price of imported panels, I think President Trump is going about this the wrong way. The right way to encourage a domestic industry in the United States is to encourage industries that are innovative, industries that play to our strengths as the most innovative economy on earth. That doesn't mean raising the price of your competitors' products. That means supporting companies that make even better products. And I think that advanced manufacturing of solar panels, brand new technologies, for example, could be an engine of job growth. This trade action is not going to encourage companies to pursue such revolutionary technologies. It's really just going to encourage them to try and make tried and true old-fashioned solar panels because the competition just got a lot more expensive.
So you've told me a lot about solar energy. Where is wind energy at and where is it headed?
Yeah, so I talked a lot about solar because you'll have some of the most explosive growth because of the tremendous cost declines in solar energy. But wind is also going to continue to have respectable growth in the coming years. And that's both wind that's onshore as well as wind that's offshore. Offshore wind in particular is going to fall in cost really fast. It's going to fall, it's projected to fall 71% by 2040 in cost. And so the reason for that is that rapidly firms like oil companies are building up the expertise to stand up these floating wind turbines offshore that are just enormous. The largest wind turbines offshore today pump out about 8 megawatts of power. The largest ones in 2025 could pump out 15 megawatts or even more. And so that's going to make wind turbines much more powerful, much cheaper, and they're going to continue to grow. So even though today less than 6% of U.S. electricity is generated by wind, that number could grow to over 10% in the coming decades.
You mentioned the Paris Climate Agreement. President Trump announced his intention to pull out of the agreement. His EPA administrator said he would scrap the Clean Power Plan, which is basically the main mechanism that the United States would comply with its obligations under the Paris Agreement. I mean, what does the sum of all these policies spell for the renewables industry? They can't be good for the renewable industry, right?
That's right, but I actually don't think it's as bad as some of the alarmist critics have made it out to be. I don't actually think that, for example, President Trump's intention to pull out of the Paris Agreement or President Trump's domestic policies like scrapping the Clean Power Plan, intending to scrap the Clean Power Plan, or even some of his actions making it easier to develop and use fossil fuels, I don't think any of these will have as much of a chilling effect on the domestic renewables market as the potential trade action against foreign solar panel imports will have. Let me explain why. The Paris Agreement really did not impose very onerous obligations on the United States. And President Trump, by announcing his intention to leave the Paris Agreement, he really hasn't affected the renewable energy market within the United States. Now, the renewable energy market within the United States can be affected by domestic policies. But the major domestic policies that support renewable energy deployment, like tax credits or like state policies, are not actually in danger. The Clean Power Plan, which was President Obama's attempt to reduce emissions from the power sector, would largely have affected coal power plants, forcing them to shut down. But it wasn't really going to speed up the deployment of renewable energy. So I don't think that President Trump's either foreign policy actions by pulling out of Paris or domestic policy actions are going to have a large effect on the domestic renewables market.
I was imagining that by now we'd have a Department of Energy report on the reliability of the electric grid that was ordered by Rick Perry, Trump's energy secretary. And a lot of people were saying that this report was going to criticize renewable energy as a sort of threat to grid reliability because they're so unstable. It seems like from leaked drafts that it's not really going to be that big of a bombshell of a report. What are your thoughts on this, on Rick Perry's intention to study grid reliability? I believe that's the key word in the report.
You know, it's unclear what's going to come out of that report. The leaked draft suggested that the Department of Energy staffers who wrote the initial draft before it went to the political appointees. The initial version was not going to say that there was much of a reliability risk from renewables. And indeed, a government laboratory, the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, has published a pretty comprehensive study explaining how the United States could get to 80% renewable energy without compromising the overall stability of the grid. But that's not going to be easy. And let me be clear, there are real issues ahead of us if the growth of renewables continues. As you put more renewables on the grid, particularly from wind and solar power that are intermittent, they only work when the wind blows or the sun shines, you really are going to have some complications. For example, in California, which already has greater than a 10% share of solar energy on its grid, you have this issue where in the middle of the day, when there's a lot of solar generation, thanks to the bright noontime sunlight, there's not a whole lot of additional need for power from other generators. But in the evening, once the solar panels shut off and the sun sets, there is a huge demand. There's what's called a ramp, an increase in power demand that is enormous per hour. And that ramp requires, for example, fossil fuel plants to spin up and start spitting out electricity at a rapid rate and increase it for several hours at a time. That puts strain on the grid. It puts strain on the power plants. It puts strain on the grid. And so going forward, as more states start to approach California's level of penetration, and as California kind of goes where no state has gone before, targeting 50% renewable energy by 2030, it's really going to have to contend with the issues that renewable energy is highly volatile. And unless you have ways to make your grid very flexible and ways to store the energy that comes from these intermittent resources, it's going to be hard to match up the supply of electricity with the demand.
So what are, how do you square that circle?
There are actually many ways to do it. And I'd caution against the myth that, you know, there's one silver bullet that, oh, we can put enough batteries on the grid and with that storage, we'd be able to smooth out the highly volatile profile of intermittent renewables. Instead, we're going to need a whole portfolio of approaches. The first is to make sure that your intermittent solar and wind generators are backed up by a whole fleet of diverse and flexible power generators. For example, nuclear plants and fossil fuel plants whose emissions are captured and stored. Now, in addition, you can also make it easier to handle an influx of intermittent renewable energy by making your grid even bigger. The bigger your grid, the more likely it is that, for example, the sun is shining in one time zone but not another, or the wind is blowing in one northerly area and not one southerly area, and you're able to transmit power from areas of surplus to areas of deficit. So this averaging or aggregation coming from large grids is possible if we build out large transmission lines linking together distant regions of the country. And finally, you could also have a smarter grid, a grid where the ways in which we use energy in our thermostats, in our water heaters, in our electric vehicles, we use it very intelligently. We turn them on and off in order to match them up with when a surplus of power is available from the volatile renewable energy. So for example, if your car only intelligently charges when the sun is shining, or if your water heater is only charging when there's a surplus of wind power, then you're going to be able to better line up your demand with your volatile supply. So these are three possible ways that you can make it easier to integrate renewable energy. They require investments, for example, in transmission lines and smart grid infrastructure. And there isn't any silver bullet. You know, batteries are often talked about. These are the lithium-ion batteries that you find in your cell phone or in a Tesla Motors vehicle. And they're great. They're getting cheaper by the day, but they're only one small part of the solution. They're pretty good at shifting some of the energy that comes from intermittent renewables by a few hours, but nothing more. So when you have variability in renewable energy production between days or between weeks or even between seasons, a battery is not going to help you out very much. So my bottom line is there's a whole portfolio of resources.
Yeah, so in hearing all these ideas, they all seem like great ideas, totally feasible, or at least we have the technology. But they also feel a little bit like the way solar panels did in the 80s or something. Like, yeah, that makes sense. We could just harness energy from the sun. But like actually getting that to happen has taken so long because there's just so many sort of legal, political, cultural you know, just infrastructure, building the infrastructure. It seems like there's a lot of work to be done before any of this becomes a reality. Or am I just misjudging it?
Absolutely. And I'll say one of the reasons that solar back in the 80s, like you say, took so long to fall in cost and get to market. One of the reasons, in my opinion, is because in the 80s, we slashed funding for research and development into better solar technologies. We really could have accelerated this whole thing, not just in solar, but across many different technologies, including nuclear or carbon capture, by heavily investing in innovation. And it's never too late. We need to do it right now. But I will say that you're absolutely right. In the electricity sector in particular, the sector is known as a legacy sector. That means that there are strong incumbents that are averse to change. We're talking, for example, about electricity utilities that operate on multi-decadal timelines that aren't really rapid and willing to be nimble. And as a result of these entrenched barriers and incumbents, it can be really hard to change the system. However, we've got to try. I'm a scientist by training, and that's why I really have faith that some of the breakthroughs in labs could shake up the way that we currently generate, transmit, and use electricity. I think that we should be heavily investing in innovation, because if you have nuclear reactors that are meltdown-proof and super cheap, if you have solar coatings that you could paint onto your wall or roof, if you have ways to capture carbon and then use it to create, for example, products out of carbon fiber, then these are all ways that are so compelling that even the barriers of the legacy sector won't be enough to stop them. That with these incredible technologies that we could invent and then bring to market, we could really shake up this entrenched legacy sector.
So that brings me to another question, which is, you know, Trump has, in his budget, he's slashed renewable energy research, and along with other lots of other government programs, a lot of climate research and climate programming. What effect would all this have on, you know, the future of renewables? And let's just put the caveat in that Trump's budget is not policy. It's just almost a political statement made to Congress. And then it's almost 0% chance that all of the things that he's asked to be cut will actually be cut. But let's just operate on the assumption that, you know, this is the general direction that he wants to take the federal budget.
So what the Trump administration proposed was to slash energy innovation across the board. The United States spends, you know, $6.4 billion on energy innovation. President Obama proposed doubling it over 5 years. President Trump has proposed slashing it in half. President Trump's most audacious proposal was to axe an agency, the Advanced Research Projects Agency in Energy,
that was modeled... Come on, man. Hit me up with some acronyms. I mean, this is there's some serious energy nerds out there, you know.
Hey, absolutely. So ARPA-E, as you know, was modeled off of DARPA in the Department of Defense. And it's one of the most popular energy programs out there. It's gotten bipartisan support. This was clearly a political statement by the Trump administration, arguing that the federal government has no business to play in trying to commercialize breakthrough energy technologies. You know, Senator Lamar Alexander, leading the Senate committee report, fired back saying that the Senate rejected the short-sighted proposal by the Trump administration. And that was right on. So we'll see what happens in reconciliation. What happens now is the House has proposed slashing energy innovation a little less than the Trump administration did, and the Senate has proposed largely keeping it the same. So nobody is doing as visionary a job as the Obama administration had proposed, but at least the Senate is holding the line on maintaining energy innovation resources. We'll see what happens in reconciliation. I expect that ARPA-E will remain fully funded and some kind of grand bargain will ensue. But frankly, what the Trump administration's opening gambit has done is kind of shift the terms of the debate. It's no longer a debate between how much do we increase funding for energy innovation. Now it's how much do we decrease it. And the best we can hope for is an outcome where we keep it exactly the same. That's going to hurt the United States. In the long run, it's going to hurt our competitiveness. We already are behind China on the manufacture of most major clean energy products, from solar panels to wind turbines to batteries. We're not going to seize back market share. We're not going to get a chance to have a part of that $300 billion clean energy pie that is growing every year unless we invest heavily in innovation.
So what are some of the major levers that Congress has its hand on in terms of the renewable energy market? We have the wind production tax credit, which has really helped spur wind development in the U.S. There's also solar tax credits. Are any of these credits or tax policies, do you see Congress touching the dials on any of this stuff?
I don't see Congress touching these dials. I think that the wind and solar tax credits were extended in a bipartisan compromise in 2015. I don't see them getting touched until they will expire sometime between 2020 and 2022. That said, I actually don't think these credits are particularly important. I mean, around the world, you're seeing renewable energy achieving deployment success without much in the way of subsidies. You know, in Mexico, in Peru, in Chile, in Abu Dhabi, in India, you're seeing the cost of solar fall. You're seeing cases where it's deployed without any subsidies at all. I think it could be very competitive in the United States even without these tax credits. And these tax credits sometimes have some distortionary effects. That aside, what else does Congress have their hand on? Well, we just talked about energy innovation. I also really support Congress supporting demonstration of new energy technologies. Look, it's not enough to develop the new technology in the lab. You've got to test it out in the field. And until you do, in, say, a cost-sharing arrangement with the private sector, private investors are going to be too skittish to invest in a big way. So unless we demonstrate the first-of-a-kind new nuclear reactor, the first-of-a-kind carbon capture and sequestration project, and there is finally a good example operating in Texas, we're not going to be able to have large scale deployment of these brand new technologies. So I really want Congress to, you know, my favorite idea came from John Deutsch at MIT. In 2011, he wrote a Brookings paper arguing that we should have an energy technology corporation, an independent corporation from the rest of the government. It's funded by a one-time appropriation from Congress. I think he asked for $60 billion. And then it invests by itself without interference, able to hire and fire like the private sector, able to invest and take stakes in companies like the private sector for the next 10 years in some of the most audacious demonstration projects. I think that would be a terrific idea, and I think Congress can do that.
I think you need to make that a reality show vis-a-vis a la Shark Tank to really get some traction these days. What do you think?
I think that would be a terrific idea. Let's put these guys on TV.
Maybe not. I'm sorry. I feel like I cut you off. So to make my really funny joke, what were you about to say? Sorry.
That's okay, Reed. I was going to say, you know, it's not just the federal government that has its hands on dials. State and local governments also can make a difference here. But again, I really want to buck conventional wisdom. Our problem is not that we need to throw more money towards solar and wind power. They will be fine. Our problem is that we need to create an enabling environment where they can thrive not only today when they're a small percentage of the electricity supply, but tomorrow, by 2040 and 2050, when they could be a much larger percentage. When by 2050, I argued that we could possibly have a majority of our electricity come from solar and wind. To enable that reality, there are all kinds of policies at both the federal and state level that we need. So at the state level, one thing you could do is to support the kind of grid expansion that I've been talking about. California, for example, has taken some baby steps toward integrating its own electricity grid with that of neighboring states. It needs to do much more of that, because if you have a much bigger grid that covers the entire western United States, it'll be easier to ship solar power when there's surplus solar in Arizona over to California when it needs it, or vice versa. A second thing that that states can do is to adjust their power market rules to encourage generators to have what's called flexibility. So we really want the renewable energy resources that come onto the grid to be good citizens of the grid. That means that they have intelligent electronics that help stabilize the grid rather than destabilize it. First Solar, a solar company, recently demonstrated that it could do that. It demonstrated that thanks to its smart inverters and power electronics on one of its facilities, it was actually able to help keep the grid's frequency operating at exactly the right level. And that's important. If you're going to have a lot more of these intermittent renewables, you're going to need to make sure that not only they, but also the other generators on the grid have incentives to help stabilize the grid, not destabilize it. But I will say that some of the state policies that we have seen historically, for example, renewable portfolio standards. These are standards that say, you know, let's mandate that there's a certain amount of renewable electricity on the grid, 33%, 50%. Those were helpful to kickstart the original the early market creation, they're not so useful now, and I don't think they're the best policy going forward. These renewable portfolio standards now are only they account for less than half of all of new solar growth around the country. And in many cases, they make an artificial distinction between zero carbon sources like renewable energy, like wind and solar, and zero carbon sources like nuclear energy that don't qualify for a renewable portfolio standard. That is an artificial and distortionary barrier and shouldn't be there. So again, states need to... Oh, finally, an important thing states should do is to cooperate on transmission line permitting. Many states can obstruct the permitting of brand new transmission lines, the really long distance ones that span continents that we need in order to make our grid large enough to sustain a high penetration of renewable energy. So there are lots of things that states can do to help bring more renewable energy onto the grid. All of these things create an enabling environment. None of these things is throwing money directly at solar and wind. Those resources don't need it right now.
It sounds like you've answered this, but solar energy, is it vulnerable to a Trump presidency that perhaps doesn't view the renewable energy industry favorably? Or is the momentum too great for it to be stopped?
You know, in the near term, the momentum is pretty great. You're going to see a lot of solar growth. It won't just be in blue states. It'll be red states, too. In a lot of places, solar is the cheapest resource you can possibly find. And barring this one kind of black swan, the potential trade case that would raise prices of all imported solar panels, and we import 95% of our solar panels, barring that eventuality, the price of solar will continue to fall and its momentum is unstoppable in the near term. But in the long run, and no one in the industry is looking at this, you know, folks in the industry are focused on you know, their margins today and next year, but not 10 years or 20 years down the line. 20 years down the line, if the United States hopes to get a majority of its energy from renewable energy, it will absolutely need to be taking some steps right now that the Trump administration does not seem to want to take. Those steps include preparing for a system that's super flexible, developing brand new technologies that will be cheap even if there's a high penetration of intermittent renewables. The Trump administration absolutely needs to look that far ahead because that's the responsibility of government. That's the responsibility of irresponsible and farsighted government. So renewables are not vulnerable today, but they are in the long run.
We should probably also just touch on this, I don't know what we're calling it, the CLACK paper. So the background is in, what was it, 2015, there was a Stanford professor authored a paper that's saying we could get to 100% renewable energy by something like 2050. And you were among the co-authors who said, no, that's not actually... 100% renewables by 2050 isn't actually a thing. Correct me if I'm wrong on that, but could you just explain that paper and what your group actually is saying in your paper?
Yeah, so more specifically, the claim that we're debunking is that going basically 100% renewable energy using wind, water, and solar, not really using batteries, using some energy storage technologies like underground thermal energy storage that haven't been proven out at the scales needed in this paper. We argued that that paper does not provide the lowest cost solution as the paper argues. We think that, in fact, it would require you to build on the order of 500 to 600 Hoover dams of hydropower capacity and do a whole lot of other things that just are not feasible. It's not to say that we don't all support a strong increase in the amount of renewable capacity. And, you know, our lead author wrote a popular Nature Climate Change paper arguing that 80% renewables was possible if we really build out the transmission grid in the United States. But we thought that the argument that we have all the tools we need, all the technologies we need, and wind, water, and solar can get us to 100% renewable, not just in power, but also for the transportation sector and the industrial sector and the building sector, we thought that was ludicrous, and that's why we wrote our paper debunking that. You know, we were I co-authored with 20 of the folks that I respect most, scholars across the country at institutions who have studied energy deeply, and we really don't believe that that was realistic. That's not to say that there isn't value in what that 100% renewable energy had become, which is a slogan, a rallying cry. You know, as soon as we published our paper, we were attacked by celebrities. For example, Mark Ruffalo suggested that we were fossil fuel hacks.
The Hulk.
The Hulk, right? And I, you know, I was thrilled out of my mind that the Hulk would tweet about me. But we aren't fossil fuel hacks. We're a bunch of honest scientists, you know, trying to argue that we should be a little more careful when we say that 100% renewables is the lowest cost solution. Right now, it's not. We need a lot of innovation. We all want to get to a place with a lot more renewables, but, you know, we aren't yet on the right track. And there are some important actions we should take. And we shouldn't rule out options, for example, nuclear power. Nuclear power is the United States' largest clean energy source. We really should not be tying one hand behind our back as we try and decarbonize our energy supply. So anyway, we recognize that 100% renewable has been a rallying cry, for example, for cities and states, but it's not a it's not scientifically accurate to argue that today's technologies in a 100% renewable configuration is the lowest cost solution. And it's important for academics to be honest.
It got pretty heated out there on the internet when your paper came out. Honestly, I was scratching my head a little bit watching these people argue about whether or not we could get to 80% renewables or 100% renewables in 30 years when we're at, like, what, 10% renewables right now? And it just, maybe you could explain, and people have since said, no, this is actually an important argument. Maybe you can explain, you know, why was it important to kind of have this public argument about the sort of limits of renewable technology?
Absolutely. The intuition, like you said, is, look, we're so far away. Why can't we just put our heads down and focus on getting some more renewables in the ground? We'll worry about 80 or 100% well down the road. That intuition, we believe is, or I believe, is dangerous. Because if you don't plan ahead, what you could do is drive yourself into a cul-de-sac rather than on the highway to where you want to go.
That's a good analogy. I like it.
The reason for this cul-de-sac metaphor is the last 10% or the last 20% of decarbonization is going to be a lot harder than the first 20%. And so you want to make sure that your first 20%, harvesting the low-hanging fruit, is sending you in the right direction and that you're not failing to take actions right now that you'll need down the road. I've been arguing throughout this session with you that we need to be taking actions that will only pay dividends years, if not decades, down the road. You know, investing in innovation, coming up with new technologies, creating a bigger and smarter and more flexible grid. Because right now, we could put our heads down, shell out a bunch of money to support wind and solar. They don't need it, but if we gave them money, they might get deployed even faster, and sit pretty for the next 5 years until we hit the point where there's too much wind and solar on the grid. You're only getting power, for example, at noontime from your solar panels, and you're failing to get any power at dinner time. And suddenly you have such volatility on the grid that you say, oh no, I wish I had a smarter, more flexible, larger grid. I wish I had brand new technologies that not only turned solar energy into electricity, but also into fuels to fuel my vehicles. You end up wishing for actions that could have been taken 5 or 10 years ago down the road. If you let the nuclear reactors in this country shut down, you will shut down the largest source of clean energy that we've already achieved. It's happening all over the country. And that would be unfortunate. It would be unfortunate to shut down your nuclear reactors based on this misplaced faith that we already have all of the renewable solutions we need in order to get to a fully decarbonized economy. And that's why we thought it was so important to correct the record. It was to say, look, we're all on the same side here. We all want to get to a decarbonized economy. We differ on our means. Let's have an honest debate. We wanted to disabuse folks of the notion that we had all the tools we need. And we wanted to say, look, there are some legitimate policy debates going forward. Let's be very careful and purposive about where we're headed. We're headed toward a world where the last bit of decarbonization is going to be very hard. Let's stock our toolkit with as many useful tools as we can.
Varun Sivaram.
I just spoke in metaphors.
Yeah,
sorry.
That was good. You're on a roll. You got the, maybe it's all the writing you've been doing. Well, Varun Sivaram is the Philip D. Reed Fellow for Science and Technology at the Council on Foreign Relations. Varun, thanks for joining us.
Reed, thanks so much for having me.
The windmills are killing hundreds and hundreds of eagles, one of the most treasured birds, and they're killing by the hundreds and nothing happens. So wind is, you know, it's a problem.
Thanks for listening to Trump on Earth. I'm Reed Frazier. If you like our show, please consider supporting us through Patreon. Just go to patreon.com/Trump on Earth. Thanks to grad student Rebecca Lessner and our intern, Paige Walter. Our producer and digital editor is Andy Kubis. I'm Reed Frazier. See you next time.
Trump on Earth is produced by the Allegheny Front, a public media outlet in Pennsylvania that covers the environment. For more environmental news, go to AlleghenyFront.org.
And Point Park University's Environmental Journalism Program. More at pointpark.edu.
You can find all of our episodes on our website, TrumpOnEarth.org. Have a question? Email us at TrumpOnEarth@gmail.com.